Sunday night edition of the pod. We got to do our final awards. We were able to eschew the full podcast for MVP because I don't think it's that close, but we're going to go through all the major awards and do some of our favorites of the year as well in our own traditional invented categories that we've been doing all season long as well. We're sponsored today by Blue Apron. Go to blueapron.com/catspace to find out how to get started with them. You'll get $30 off your first order if you go to that blueapron.com/capspace URL. And also, if you're interested in our other sponsors, you can just go to my webpage, nateduncannba.com, click on the other news link, and the top of those is our entire list of sponsors in case you missed the code or the name of the sponsors, because I know you're paying the absolute closest attention to all of our ads. So let's get started with MVP here, Mr. LaRue.
The top line is not as challenging as before. James Harden is having an absolutely spectacular season. My stats are a couple days old, but they're still pretty close. And PER just under 30. Just remarkable how good the Rockets offense has been when he's been on the floor. Offensive rating around 115. Usage at 36 is just absolutely insane. That's the ESPN iteration of usage. There are a couple different versions of it. And certainly there, one of the arguments is that the Rockets have been better with Harden off the floor. I mean, better with Harden off the floor than like they were in other years. They're still obviously a greater positive with him on the floor. And one of my counters to that is, A, most teams don't have Chris Paul in their second unit a lot of the time. And secondly, Harden's excellence to me has allowed the Rockets to stagger their guys in a way that might not have been as palatable for other teams. And so to me, that superlative offensive season and the fact that really nobody in this mix had a truly strong defensive season made it a pretty easy call.
Well, in this mix, I mean, you're just saying that Giannis and AD are not in the mix? Because I think they both had pretty good defense seasons.
Yeah, but not, you know, like, let's say what Kawhi did last year.
Yeah, I wouldn't say either of them. Is at that level.
Like, it's more to me what they did is more of a tiebreaker than a real decisive factor in their favor.
Yeah, and for me, I had James Harden as well. My only competition was LeBron James. With Cleveland having the 29th ranked defense and Houston being a top 10 unit, I think that while Harden has a lot of limitations, he's been an effective part of their scheme to switch everything. And LeBron, although he obviously has more talent to be a positive defender, he has been so unengaged this year, as we talked about on worst team all defense. I think that he has really been a negative for their defensive culture with all the plays that he has clearly taken off, both in transition and in help defense or getting out on shooters, any of those. So the argument for James there really only comes down to two things for me. He's played 400 more minutes than Harden has. Harden missed about 2 weeks, also missed a game for rest. James has not missed anything. But, you know, I think once you get above kind of 73, 74 games, you know, that's kind of the expectation for a full season in this day and age. So I don't take too much of a penalty for Harden on that. And then James's clutch stats have been absolutely preposterous this year. He's been easily the best clutch player in the NBA. 48% usage in the clutch gets games, plus or minus 5 points in the last 5 minutes. This is one of the all-time great clutch seasons for a team. They've won 7.4 more games than expected to be 19 games over 500 with basically a neutral point differential. It's absolutely remarkable, and it bears directly on what LeBron has done in the clutch. Not only does he have 48% usage and 64% true shooting, he's got a 61% assist percentage. So he's doing absolutely everything, and in the clutch, plus 18 net rating. Harden himself, though, has been no slouch. He is 44% usage, 56% true shooting, is a little less efficient than he's been overall in the year at 62%. Both those guys are about the same in true shooting on the year. But Harden, 35% assist percentage and plus 21 net rating in the clutch as well. So James has the advantage there, but it's not a huge one. And then the number one thing I would point to for Harden, in addition to just the team being better, the offense being better, is that he has 5% higher usage and the same efficiency. And so that, to me, I mean, that 5% higher usage is massive. And so, I mean, people who say, oh, you know, they're equal statistically, I don't believe that to be the case. I think Harden has had the better statistical season. And when you look at the on-off metrics as well, that's the case. LeBron is, I believe, 17th as of this recording in RPM, and James Harden is second behind his teammate, Chris Paul. all. And LeBron usually is up in the top five, especially because of his defense this year. That has not been the case. So I think James Harden, especially with the team success that Houston has experienced, a very clear MVP and one of the strongest that we've seen.
A phenomenal year for him. I'm happy you brought up the LeBron clutch stats because I was going to as well. And that's also why LeBron, to me, had pretty well separated himself as number two over the other players on the list, who are all having good seasons, to be sure. And the other element that LeBron and Harden both have that everybody else doesn't is that they are the centerpiece, and they've stayed healthy, of elite offenses, and that offense revolves around them. So LeBron, you know, the Cavs have an offensive rating for the whole season around 112 when LeBron is on the floor. And for most of the season, he has been their shot creator. You know, he has been the guy. Isaiah Thomas had a massively disappointing season when he was even available, and he wasn't available a lot. They got George Hill. George Hill's missed a bunch of time as well. So LeBron has had to shoulder that burden in a way even that Harden did not, but Harden has its stretches of time and has absolutely succeeded. So to me, that separates LeBron from what I have as the next two is Giannis and Anthony Davis. Those guys to me have very similar overall cases. It was actually very tough for me to separate the two of them. I ended up going with Giannis over AD, largely due to consistency. Davis has been fabulous. He's been better than Giannis for the last month, but the overall body of work, both of these teams rise and fall with their player, and both of these guys have been fabulous this year. So I'm going to go with the player who on a given night, I felt like I knew more of what I was going to get from them than Davis, who, as David Locke originally articulated, but you and I have talked about over it, he is the least consistent superstar overall this season of any of them.
Yeah, that's been the case. I mean, neither of these guys has been like a huge clutch star, although Giannis has at least been efficient. Both of those teams, though, have been solid clutch teams that have outperformed their point difference. Actually, the New Orleans is right about in line. The Bucks have outperformed it. I think I went with AD over Giannis. I think Giannis has tailed off just a little bit at the end, but this is really splitting hairs. I mean, I don't have an amazing argument for why I think it should be AD. Maybe he brings a little bit more defensively every night than Giannis. Certainly, New Orleans defense has been better than the Bucks defense, especially once Cousins went down. I think that AD has been a big part of why they've been able to keep it together. And I think these teams have been pretty similar quality, and AD is, for most of the year to me, has had less talent around him than Giannis. So I would go with AD over Giannis, but again, very close. I'm very curious to see who your fifth person was here, because you got to go five deep. This is one where I guess actually looking at it, I have a pretty obvious choice, but who's yours?
Damian Lillard.
That's mine too.
I think Lillard he's had a really good year, and one of the big differences between him and the other guys that I thought were in consideration other than LaMarcus Aldridge is that he stayed healthy. I would not say Lillard has, when he's been on the floor, had a better season than maybe Jimmy Butler. That's a harder case. I didn't really research it, or even Steph Curry, but Damian Lillard has been out there, and we've seen his absence actually the last couple games, and they've really missed that, but wonderful offensive season overall, and just such a phenomenal talent. So a step below Giannis and AD also, especially because while the Blazers have shocked defensively, and I think Lillard has been more of a positive in that than I anticipated, he is not providing as much defensive value as either Giannis or AD. But, you know, 30% usage, 60% true shooting, 21% assist rate, 25 PER, just a really great year for him. And most valuable is about not only how great you play, but how much you play. And so I think he was pretty clear cut for me. I had other guys that I thought about, and then I just, like, Lillard just kept on knocking him down.
Yeah, and also for Lillard, not as high of a clutch usage as some of these guys, 34%, but 62% true shooting in the clutch. He's had some pretty massive clutch games as well. So he was my number five, very clearly. Let's move to first team All-NBA right after this from our friends at Blue Apron, the leading meal kit delivery service in the U.S. If you don't know what Blue Apron is, it delivers prepackaged, pre-measured ingredients right to your door. I've found when I've tried to recreate their meals by going to a high-end grocery store, and I've been very impressed with the quality of their ingredients, so I think it's comparable to a high-end grocery store, you're going to spend a ton more, and you're going to have a lot of food waste as well when you go there and you buy this enormous bunch of cilantro that you're going to use like one-eighth of, and then you're probably not going to have another recipe for the rest of the cilantro, and you have to throw it away. I mean, that happens all the time. So Blue Apron really avoids that. They'll deliver you your meals once a week in a box with some dry ice in it, so it keeps it nice and fresh. my fiance and I, we like to do the four-person meals. So we actually have some leftovers. We'll do that a couple times a week. They've got 12 new recipes each week. You can pick two, three, or four recipes based on what best fits your schedule. I just would encourage you to go check out some of the recipes at that blueapron.com/capspace URL. I think you'll be really impressed with the quality of stuff. And I found that I've been able to actually, with their instructions, make all of these meals and have them all taste good. So they do a great job of hand-holding you through the process. You can get stuff like popcorn chicken with sweet chili cabbage slaw and cumin spice wonton noodles with vegetables and peanuts. That's just one example of what they have this month. So just go check it out. If you see something that piques your interest, you might as well give it a shot. Because of that blueapron.com/capspace URL, you can get $30 off your first order. That's Blue Apron, a better way to cook at blueapron.com/capspace, the URL. Use that slash capspace URL. Let them know that you came from us. Let's move now to first team All-NBA. And as I began to think about this more in the last weeks, I started talking to more of our compatriots who were doing this exercise as well. As I saw what you had done, I decided that, especially because there's so much weakness at the forward position once you get down to third team, that generally I wanted to try to engineer this so I could get the best players on each individual team, as long as I could do it in an intellectually honest way, moving guys to positions that they actually play this year. So you can guess, obviously, that it happened to work out here that my top five in MVP was also my first team All-NBA. And I think Harden, LeBron, those guys are obvious. I had been struggling at the other forward spot with either Giannis or AD. I think you even put LeBron on second team last time. But with AD, between varying estimates, 43% at center per cleaning the glass. He's closing basically every game at center since Cousins went down. Another estimate I saw had it as 48%. So that's enough for me to vote him as a center. I voted him as a center in the past. We think that that's his best position. So I feel very comfortable putting him at center, and I think he's been significantly better than the other centers. And so if there's a way to get him onto the first team, I wanted to do it. So Lillard and Harden at guard, LeBron and Giannis at forward, AD at center is my first team All-NBA.
Yeah, I ended up with a similar thought exercise here, but my top five for MVP is not my top five for All-NBA. So what I did, I fudged it a little bit with AD. I said the line was 45%. He's at, last time I checked it, at 43% at center. But I'm just like, that's close enough. I'm cool with that. So the only difference that I had, and remember, we've talked about this before, but I see All-NBA as more about most outstanding rather than most valuable. So I still had, I think Curry has been more outstanding than Lillard this year. It's a very close call between those two guys, and I would have zero opposition to people who think Lillard has been better, but just on a per minute basis, I think that's a little bit more important. So I put Curry there. That is our only disagreement.
Yeah, you know what? I couldn't do it with Curry. I agree he's been better than Lillard. I think he is better than Lillard, but, and this is time to get into the guards. I mean, Lillard played 900 minutes more than Steph Curry. He's going to be about 2,500 minutes. Steph's about 1,600 minutes. So yeah, Steph Curry was unbelievable this year, and we can talk more about him, but I still had him down in this other group, which for the rest of the guards, which is impossible. And to me, Dame was the only guy, you know, he didn't play at quite the same level as Curry, but I thought he played at as good or better of a level than all the rest of the guards. And he's got at least a 500 minute advantage on all those guys. So I went with Lillard again. This is the eye of the beholder. I agree with you that Curry's a better player, that he played better on a per minute basis this year, but only 51 games, only 1600 minutes, just not enough for me. And so that's why I went with Lillard on the first team, as I did in MVP. But let's get to the rest of the guard line here, especially second team All-NBA. I assume Lillard was one of your two on second team All-NBA.
Oh yeah, absolutely. No hesitation. He was my top guy. And my second one, no surprise to longtime listeners of the podcast, is Chris Paul. I think Chris Paul has been the fourth best guard in the league. Also, now with all the injuries that kind of happened around, I think some of the play time issues that happened early in the season, because he missed most of his time early on, have balanced out. So I think Chris Paul's relatively clearly the fourth best guard. And then if you want to continue,
let's break into this. I got a few stats here for you just in terms of some of the minutes plays. I mean, to me, I thought that all these guys were very similar, right? Steph is probably the best player of all these guys. I know you had him on on first team, but this was my second team analysis. Is probably the best player of all these guys. He played the fewest minutes at 1600. Chris Paul, probably the second best player of these guys, especially when you throw in his defense. The second fewest minutes, 1753. Kyrie Irving played 1900 minutes this year. Then you have Jimmy Butler, 2077 minutes, but I solved that problem by moving him to second team forward, where it really drops off after KD. So my second team forwards are Butler and KD. I think that's pretty clear, because the third team forwards... Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's not what I did. I moved Butler. Butler was a third team forward. I actually had LaMarcus Aldridge, who we'll get to more of, as my center on second team, or as my forward on second team. Wow, I'm totally blowing this. So anyway, let me get back to this. And then Victor Oladipo, 2,471 minutes, 72 games. Russell Westbrook, way ahead in minutes with 2,800, but probably the weakest individual statistical case of a lot of these guys, just with his inefficiency this year and the fact that just I think he's, outside of Irving, might be the worst defensively on a game-to-game basis for these candidates. And there's also the question of just like how it seems like everyone who joins his team as an individual just seems to play worse a lot. I mean, they're getting some of the same shots that they used to make, but it really, I don't know whether it's the fact that he disempowers those guys or just they don't happen to play well or whatever, but you know, that is a trend that I think it's time to at least acknowledge. So with all of that, I felt like, you know, the best players played fewer minutes, the worst players played more minutes, that kind of all evens out. And so when everyone is flawed a little bit in these ways, I just picked the two guys that I thought were the best players, and that ended up being Steph and Paul. So that's how I got to my second team guards.
Okay, so we ended up on the guard line in pretty much the same spot. Do you want to finish out the guards, or do you want to go to the forwards?
Well, why don't we go forwards here, because there's a little cross matching in terms of the positions.
Sure.
So AD was my first team center. Joel Embiid,
sure.
I probably would have had Aldridge. If you had to put a gun to my head, I would have at center, I would have gone with Aldridge instead of Embiid, because Aldridge, he dropped off a little bit, but he's just been unbelievable again in this last month or so. I mean, he's just the only thing keeping the Spurs afloat offensively. The lack of spacing that he's had to deal with to still be efficient. The fact that he faces double teams, that he has no one to pass it to who can shoot, and he still turns it over on 6.3% of his possessions is just absolutely ridiculous. And he's not, he goes to a fair amount of fadeaways and stuff, but he gets into the lane. Like, he actually like makes plays. And so he's been incredible. I mean, like what he did, for example, in that game against the Jazz, even against the Lakers, which they lost, he was unstoppable. They probably didn't give him the ball enough then, frankly. So, but I felt that Embiid was really good too. And I felt that the center position is stronger towards the bottom than the forward position. Aldridge certainly plays plenty of forward, although I think he's at his best at center. So I ended up putting him as a forward. KD was the clear other forward. I mean, he's had a little bit of a down year in terms of games played and maybe his defense, but he's still just an unstoppable offensive force. And I think he's a better player than AD. I think he's a better player than Giannis. It's just those guys have played more games and been a little more engaged this year. You know, if you wanted to say who I'd rather have my team in the playoffs, I'd say KD than those guys. So that's why I went there. And then I was able to move Embiid into my second team all NBA center position and get another center in on the third team, who I thought was deserving, because the choices at third team forward, if I had had to swing another forward in and had Aldridge at the center, then I would have had to go down to like, you know, an Al Horford, or, you know, I guess it probably would have been Horford, but I think he's a level below so most of the guys are talking about, especially offensively.
Oh, so wait, so I think I might have missed this. So who did you pick as your third team center?
We didn't say that yet, but that's going to be Karl Anthony Towns.
Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting way of doing it. I ended up going with Aldridge. So I went with Aldridge as my third team center and then had Horford, but you could swap Horford for Towns. I wouldn't have too much opposition to that either way. Those guys, yeah, I mean, I think you're fudging it was probably better than mine.
Yeah, I think that's good, because you really did better fudging than I did in previous months. But yeah, I think I just, this is a way to get the most overall talent onto the three teams in a way that's still intellectually honest.
And so a part of this is like, when you think about this 10 to 20 years from now, you want the 15 best players on this, because that's a part of the story of the season and these guys' careers. If a player is one of the best 15, but the reason they don't make it is because of the position, especially when they're so fluid right now, I think that's unfair to those people when they don't have the benefit of the living through this like we have. that.
Yeah. And Al Horford, I mean, he's played some power forward more as they've had all these injuries, but you know, even he is probably best as a center too. So he's not like just, oh, let's throw him in there at forward automatically either. So I'll get to my third team now. You finished out your second team, right?
Yeah, I did for the sake of clarity. Lillard, Paul, Durant, Butler, Embiid.
Yeah, so you moved Butler to forward as well. So basically our big difference there was you ended up with, was Aldridge your third team center?
Yeah, he was, though now I'm considering, I think I'll move him to third team power forward and put our third team forward and put Townsend. I think that's a better choice than Horford.
Yeah, okay.
He deserves
well,
it
good.
More.
All right, well, I actually convinced you. Maybe after the over-unders one, if you...
Well, I'd already made the fudge, and I'm just sitting there, I already made that, and I'm like, why am I, now I'm sitting there going, well, why am I married to Aldridge at the five when I had basically had to make a decision to slide him over in the first place?
Yeah, yeah. All right, so I guess it wasn't me who convinced you. I was about to say that maybe you learned your lesson after the Sacramento Kings in the over-unders, but I guess...
Hey, you convinced me on the Magic. Yeah. That was a good
win.
No,
that's true. I wish I hadn't. I would have beaten you this year if I had not done that. So here's my third team, and we'll go back to the guards again. So the remaining candidates that I have here are Irving, Oladipo, Russell Westbrook, and then you could throw DeMar DeRozan in there as well. I just don't think he's as good of a player as these guys. If you look at the on-off statistics, he's really never been in the neighborhood of the guys we're talking about in his career, even when we're talking about offensive RPM. And he's a solid player, but I just, you know, I don't see him as the type of force that the rest of these guys have been offensively. So to me, it really came down to Irving, Oladipo, and Westbrook. Irving played the best out of those three, played the fewest minutes, of course, 1,900 minutes. Oladipo, I thought, was a little bit better than Westbrook, ironic enough, considering. And I thought the tiebreaker to me between Oladipo and Westbrook in particular was Oladipo has been really good defensively this year. He's had one of the best steal rates. I think, what did he have, like 45 straight games with a steal or something like that? And steals aren't everything defensively, obviously, but they definitely matter to just take away a possession from the other team and give yourself a transition opportunity most of the time. KP, we haven't done our all defense yet, but KP, I think, had him on his all defensive team. And I think he's really, really improved. The Pacers have gotten a lot better defensively as the year has gone on. And while Oladipo, we thought maybe early in the year that it could just be an artifact of his incredible shooting on pull-up jump shots, well, that's evened out and he's remained effective. And I really liked his efficiency this year. He's been more efficient than Westbrook. So I just gave it to Oladipo over Westbrook, just barely. It's tough though. Westbrook had the better overall career, but I think especially that first month and a half of the season for Westbrook was so ugly statistically. And he's been better than that. Maybe you want to treat that as an outlier. And then just his defense being so bad. And finally, the fact that he just, despite all the assists that he gets, like doesn't really seem to provide an ecosystem where anyone else can flourish with the ball. I mean, even the only one who's been able to do it really has been Kevin Durant. And then, you know, maybe Harden a little bit as a bench guy very early in his career. So I don't know how much of that to blame on Russ, but it has been a trend these last few years. So I left Russell Westbrook off my all NBA team, although certainly that was difficult to do. And I thought Irving was just so good this year when he played. And also the last tiebreaker here too, Westbrook has been really bad in the clutch this year, basically the polar opposite of what he was last year. You know, same ridiculously high, over 40% usage, but true shooting percentage in the 40s. And then Irving has been outstanding in the clutch. His clutch stats, I don't have written down. But
wait, who's were you looking at? Because I actually have it up. Kyrie Irving, 47.4 usage, 58.8 true shooting, 117 offensive rating. Celtics 21-13 in clutch situations, 34 assist percentage.
Yeah, and then Oladipo, he's been really awesome in the clutch too. 59% true shooting, 41% usage for him. So if you're looking for yet another tiebreaker, I think that's it. So that's why Russell Westbrook is not on my All NBA team. And then the forwards, you know, kind of just by default here, Butler didn't play that many minutes, but obviously it was awesome when he did. And Paul George, you know, has had a down year for him, but I challenge you to come up with who's been the better forward than him. There wasn't really anyone particularly in consideration.
Yeah, it wasn't close. And I mean, if certain guys like Draymond Green had better seasons, then yeah, we would be talking a different way, but they didn't, so we're not.
Yeah, so Karl Towns over Rudy Gobert and Nikola Jokic and Al Horford, you know, that's probably the other one that was a struggle. angle here. I think that Towns, when he really gets into it, he can be a little bit better than Jokic defensively, and he's just more of an unstoppable force on offense than Jokic. And interesting that these two guys matched up on Thursday night as we're recording this, because Danny's in Orlando now as you're listening to this. But I thought that the Gobert has been better this year than either Jokic or Towns on a per-play basis, but Gobert is going to be on pace for 56 games, and Towns, you know, really plays more minutes than any big man in the league. And while he's gotten tired, certainly at times, and that's bled into his defense, he's managed to play just so much. And when that's really, that's a tiebreaker for us here compared to Gobert, who's still, I mean, he's been so incredibly valuable defensively, and this Jazz team has been awesome. But that's why I went with Towns. Gobert plays a few more games, it probably would be him.
Yeah, and while I lean more than you do to more outstanding than more valuable, this is about where the line has to be for it to get there. And I mean, just it's just such a big difference in terms of time played. And part of the reason why that matters is also because of the idea of variance. You know, if Gobert had played more games, yeah, maybe the Jazz would have been similarly awesome, but maybe they wouldn't have been.
Yeah,
maybe
I like that idea, actually, that it is easier to put up a superlative performance in fewer games just because you could be benefiting from random chance. That's actually something that I hadn't looked at as much, but I think that there is something to that.
Yeah, and so it's a close call. All those players are deserving, and incidentally, a lot of them are more deserving than Horford, so I'm happy I made that switch for my own purposes, thinking about this for the long term. But, and that sucks, because Horford had a wonderful season earlier on. It's just that he tapered off a little bit, which certainly can happen.
Yeah, and he's
I
get the idea that he's like a very underappreciated player. I mean, I've been leading the Al Horford train for how good he is for a long time, but there is a point at which just being very good in a lot of areas isn't enough to overcome like guys who are dominant in particular areas. And I think that, you know, when you start talking about Towns and you start talking about Gobert, you're reaching that. I mean, Jokic versus Horford would be an interesting one, but Al doesn't play that many minutes either, so that's another reason why you might move away from him. Let's talk defensive player of the year now. With Joel Embiid's injury, probably very unlikely to play the rest of the regular season, we'll assume that Gobert plays these final 3-4 games or so, and I probably would have stuck with Embiid. I think it would have been agonizingly close, but Gobert is going to finish with just about as many minutes as Embiid, and I think he's been, I don't want to say the gap is quite as big as a lot of people want to say, but Gobert does play with more effort. He's better getting out of the perimeter. He provides multiple efforts more often, in better shape than Embiid. So I would go with Gobert, and he's played a historically awesome level defensively this year. And I just wish he could have stayed on the court a little bit more, but he benefited from the fact that Kawhi didn't play at all, that Draymond had a down year. And so I thought Gobert was clearly the best defensive player in the league this year. And the games played and the minutes played are close enough now with Embiid that I would go with Gobert.
I went with Gobert as well, but I have been frustrated. And some of this is by Utah people who have an agenda, which I understand. I mean, especially with how great a year Gobert has had, but you don't have to praise Gobert by also kind of denigrating what Embiid did. Embiid has a really good profile. It's just not over the same duration of time. And it's funny, the elements of it that are actually similar. This is old hat by this point, but reducing the proportion of shots in the restricted area and lowering the effectiveness, something both of these guys do very well. Embiid actually has a better opponent, like a stronger, meaning weaker in that sense, opponent field goal percentage or shots he defended at the rim, which is, you know, a relevant piece. Gobert's a way better defensive rebounder. And where I kind of ended up going with this is the Jazz have been a better defensive team with Gobert on the floor than with Embiid, and there are theoretical mitigating factors in that, like if it was more of a team effort or it was more of, you know, circumstance or there was luck involved. Well, there's more luck involved on Embiid's side than Gobert's, because the opponent three-point shooting is imbalanced with Embiid a little bit in terms of team shooting better when he's off the floor and worse when he's on, and with Gobert that's pretty close to even. And they both have talent, good surrounding talent. I don't you know, I'm sure Covington will do better in our all defensive teams than a lot of the guys on the Jazz, but the Jazz talent is plenty good. So I went with Gobert for that reason. And you know, these guys both had fabulous years. Celebrate both of them, but Gobert was better.
Yeah, so Embiid was number two for me. I went with Al Horford as my third place on my imaginary ballot.
So did I. This is the challenge we've gone through for years with the Celtics of, okay, they're a great defense, who gets the credit? And it is a team effort, but also a lot of the other teams in the top five didn't really have somebody ready to point out, and I didn't feel comfortable giving it. Like, I briefly considered like Paul George on the Thunder, but that is also a team effort. I think that Adams and Robertson's roles and their success have been somewhat underappreciated. Robertson maybe by his absence, and so Horford, he kind of stood out as the next best guy. And incidentally, I didn't really consider him for Defense Player of the Year, but I just want to give a mention because we haven't in this podcast too, the role that LaMarcus Aldridge played on the Spurs this year. I mean, I would have never expected them without Kawhi to be this good defensively, especially with Danny Green missing time too. And so I didn't really put him too hard in the Defensive Player of the Year candidates, but I wanted to give him credit for that.
Yeah, I thought he was great against Julius Randle tonight, for example, and he's more mobile than he looks, although he still, you know, can get traffic coned by the best guys, but he's part of that Spurs system. He's been excellent there. Something that should have been mentioned when we talked about him in the All-NBA candidacy. This year, to me, I mean, we say this every year, but this year I really mean it. Coach of the Year was extremely difficult. I think that there really were probably four or five guys that I can look at, and it's not just based on, oh, this team exceeded preseason expectations, right? Like, it's not just that. It's, you can point to the things that these coaches have done well, even specific adjustments that they've made it at times. But my Coach of the Year, and to me, he cemented it with this latest stretch, the 6-game winning streak with Kyrie out, and that's Brad Stevens.
I went with Stevens as well. I've been lower, kind of quote-unquote lower on him in terms of the Coach of the Year rankings, but they've been so good, and it's been a lot of it execution-based. Terry Rozier playing the way that he has, their defense getting all these bumps in the road with personnel and still being number one in the league. I mean, it's been a really impressive year for him. But as I want to echo something you said, I think this is, to me, the strongest Coach of the Year field that I can think of, and I wanted to rattle off some of the other people. So Popovich, to me, the Spurs are going to be close to a 50-win season when Kawhi Leonard played 210 minutes. That is jaw-dropping when you think about the, like, kind of one of the criticisms you and I have had about their personnel decisions over the last couple of years has been that they didn't build as deep a team, or, you know, a top heavy a team around Kawhi as we would have liked. Well, still got to that level, and Kyle Anderson's had an amazing year. You think about guys like that. Dwayne Casey, the way that the Raptors offense has been retooled and renovated, that is very important. Also, they've been strong defensively this year, something that has been largely a Casey hallmark during his years in Toronto. Quinn Snyder and the Jazz, I mean, not only do they have the kind of performance relative to talent level stuff, including Donovan Mitchell having this year, but you see it in the way that they play, that they, like, the stuff they run, they are prepared for every game. I remember being blown away in certain elements of what they did against the Wolves a little while back, and just, it was like last week or something like that. And the other one, I don't think he's with that top four. There are a couple other guys like Terry Stotts that I think I could include in this group, but I wanted to single out Brett Brown because Brett Brown has had such a crazy hard job this year because the pieces on the Sixers are just so unusual, and to fit a lot of these guys in and make them buy in defensively is pretty incredible.
Yeah, Brett Brown, I've been really impressed. You mentioned the fact that they have some odd pieces. I mean, to get something out of Simmons and the way he's used JJ Redick's shooting, it's a lot of creative sets that aren't that common but make a lot of sense. Going to the post-ups with Embiid, even though that's something that has kind of been eschewed of late, he's used the weapons that he's had so well, and especially when you consider how limited some of those bench units were earlier in the year, and now that they have some bench pieces that make sense and give him a lot more shooting, you've seen how much they've taken off. And for him to be able to get Ben Simmons, who was just totally disengaged as a defender at LSU, to play, you know, fringe all defense consideration type of defense this year, to get what he has out of Embiid, to manage the fact that Joel Embiid, like, doesn't practice, and yet, you know, they don't make mistakes, he's part of the team, to manage all the bullshit around Markel Fultz this year, and then actually have Fultz come back and even though he can't shoot a jumper, still be, like, effective and help them. I mean, that's been incredible. So he was not on my top four, but that's amazing that we can say all these great things about him and he wouldn't be in the top four. A couple others. Did you mention Nate McMillan at all?
No, but we absolutely should.
And McMillan, it's a little harder because it's tough to point to, you know, exactly what he's done. But I think the biggest thing you can say is he's just wound up Victor Oladipo and let him go. And we didn't know that Victor Oladipo could do this. And now they run high pick and roll for Victor Oladipo at the end of every game over and over again and just kill just about everybody. And, you know, we didn't know that he was this player. He's gotten a ton out of Sabonis. Also, you know, letting him handle the ball at the elbow, playing him at center. Miles Turner, I think he's used Turner is an interesting piece offensively. He's used him in a way to get him more pick and pops where he's been useful. So I wouldn't say that he's like this absolute strategic master, but he's done a nice job this year. And then another guy who, because he won it last year, isn't going to get enough credit this year is probably D'Antoni. And you can say, yeah, you know what? All right, they won 55 last year. They added Chris Paul. It makes sense. They're going to win 66 or 67, whatever it's going to be this year. But two things that he said. I mean, I think the idea that, oh, they're playing so much ISO ball is a little bit overblown. But what they are doing is enabling the ISO ball by running pick and rolls that the opponent has to switch with their worst defender. And then James Harden and Chris Paul are cooking that player. And I think they've just been merciless in going after that. They still have a few pet sets as well, but generally making sure that they stick with enough spacing. And then defensively, you know, Jeff Bezdelic, his assistant, deserves a lot of credit for this also. But the idea, and I think this is really going to pay off in the playoffs, is just switching everything all the time. You know, this, they have been more aggressive with that than any team I think we've ever seen. And they've, even with, you know, guys like Capella, who, you know, can switch a little bit, but to say, hey, you know what, you're just going to do this every time. And you've got Chris Paul and James Harden, and we're going to have those guys battle in the post, and we'll double team if we need to. And they just are getting so much practice with that scheme. I think it's really going to pay off for them against Golden State, avoiding mistakes against some of that Golden State offense. So D'Antoni deserves a lot of credit, but I said Brad Stevens is my number one. I don't think I even had this guy in my top three at any point in the year, but Quinn Snyder has gotten the Utah Jazz the sixth best net rating in the NBA. They've won 27 out of their last 32 games at this recording, and so he is my number two coach of the year.
I put Snyder at three and Pop at two, but you could put him in either order. I have no opposition to that.
So Dwayne Casey we had a little bit higher. He actually still was number three for me, and you know, I go back and forth on that because I don't think that he's not like the absolute smartest end of game coach. They still struggle a little bit at the end of games, but to take a team, shoot so many more threes, so many more passes, so many more assists, moving the ball, the bench was awesome again this year, even though they didn't have Kyle Lowry on that bench unit anymore. They still have the best bench net rating in the NBA, I believe. And just to take a team that like has had such disappointing playoff results and have them come back and be like, hey, we're going to change, but we're going to do this again, and we're going to have a great regular season. I still don't feel that great about their playoff chances, but to get them to even this level in the regular season is a great accomplishment, especially defensively. I mean, this is not a team you look at as like, oh man, look how good their defense is. They've had, what, top five defense all year. And so, and then the way they push the ball in transition on the second unit, I think, well, you know, it's not like the most complex stuff in the world. I think you just have to give credit to what they've done. I had Popovich at four, and I realize that he's considered a great coach. There's just been a few too many things that he's done that I kind of think could have just been done a little bit better to where I put him below Casey. I think you're only supposed to have three on this ballot, but I wanted to say that he was four. Just playing way too many lineups that don't have enough spacing. This lineup that they've been starting recently with Aldridge at center, with Danny Green and Kyle Anderson. Yeah, Green has missed time, I get that, but just to not go to that until very recently and then actually go away from that as well against the Lakers yesterday. But like, that lineup has just been unbelievable lately. But I, whenever he goes to a lineup that has just a little bit more mobility and spacing, like, it seems to work, and he just doesn't do it that much. They generally just don't play Danny Green enough, I don't think. So they're just some little things that
I have a couple counters. Yeah. One, they're fourth in defense despite having, to me, significantly inferior personnel to a lot of the teams around them in defensive ranking, just with who's actually played this year. Also, the way that they managed DeJounte Murray, I think, has been very impressive. That wasn't the key point in favor of Brett Brown, but Murray, I think that's worked out relatively well. He's gotten to the right place at the right time of the year. I don't think that if they had done it earlier, it really would have worked out.
Yeah, I don't know that Tony Parker to go along with that. It has worked out, though. I mean, like, I think I would rather be starting Patty Mills over him, even so. I mean, it's just like, and now maybe that the, and especially when they were starting him and still starting two bigs at the same time, I mean, that was kind of like, I'm still not sure that he's the best option. Maybe you feel like, hey, Kawhi's not going to come back, let's make this a developmental season. And Murray has been unbelievable defensively. I mean, I think he deserves a lot of consideration for an all defensive team. He really causes problems. And
I might put him on. I haven't decided all the way
yet. Yeah, no, I still have to really go through it. But others certainly have mentioned that. So, it was just a little bit. a great performance by him. You know, he could have easily been the coach of the year in another season. It's just, especially Snyder, just been on an absolute rocket ship lately. So that's that was tough. And even I think another guy who just deserves a slight bit of mention is Luke Walton, who does some weird shit with the lineup sometimes, but getting this totally young team to defend, it's another thing that Stevens deserves somewhat credit for, is like, think of all the young, inexperienced guys who've defended well on the Celtics this year. But Luke Walton has managed to get a young team to defend, a young team that has a lot of guys who are going to be free agents, a lot of distractions this year with the cap space that they have over the summer, a lot of guys who are going to want new contracts, be free agents. To get them to stay together has been good. I mean, it hasn't been some unbelievable coaching performance, but I think that at least deserves mention.
We've gone a full 45 minutes on this podcast and haven't done what might be the most divisive category of the entire ballot, Rookie of the Year.
Oh, man.
Well, you know what, Jazz fans? You got Defensive Player of the Year, so don't be as mad. Ben Simmons has had a better year than Donovan Mitchell. Both guys have exceeded expectations. Mitchell has exceeded expectations by more, but Ben Simmons is the primary ball handler on a shockingly successful team, especially when you consider some of the spacing issues related to their personnel. He has been more efficient as a scorer despite not taking jump shots.
Well, wait a minute. Let me push back on that. Yeah, as a scorer, but when you throw in his turnovers, I think actually Mitchell has been more efficient. 19% turnover.
Yeah, but then if you're throwing in turnovers, then I think you throw in the assist numbers, where Simmons really dwarfs Mitchell. You know, that he just has a larger, he has a larger role within that part. Like, I mean, his is just, I mean, the assist rate's about double.
Yeah.
And I think that's significant in its own way. Both guys have been good defensively, and they have very different responsibilities. Simmons plays a lot with Embiid and Covington, and Šarić has taken on a larger role as well. So depending on the game, sometimes he has a really tough assignment, sometimes it's more manageable. Mitchell's has bounced around too. But for me, just the overall body of work, degree of difficulty is high for both these guys. I think degree of difficulty is a little bit higher for Simmons, and I think he has done a somewhat better job. So I feel pretty good about it. It's a tougher race than I ever thought it would be, but Simmons is my pick.
I went with Mitchell.
Interesting.
And this is, of course, not the be-all, end-all here, but you mentioned, oh, Simmons, he's been the primary ball handler, and yeah, okay. I don't want to, believe me, this is incredibly hard, and I had Simmons, I think, at most points here throughout the season, and this isn't even necessarily a case of effectiveness, but this is just something to think about. Donovan Mitchell, clutch usage, 44%. Ben Simmons, clutch usage, 19%. And, you know, Mitchell hasn't been that efficient, only 49% true shooting. That's not amazing, but it does just show a little bit to me the difference in roles. And I think that offensively, Mitchell has had a much harder role than Ben Simmons. Ben Simmons does not have the pressure on him to score. He can kind of dribble the ball up, he can pass it, he can go do some other stuff, he can be off the ball. It's someone else's job to score. Maybe it could be him, maybe he can set people up, but you know, he is a great passer. But just going against a set defense, having to score, having to be the main guy on a team like this, you know, and they're pretty even in terms of team quality overall, so that's not really much of a tiebreaker to me. I think that Donovan Mitchell has been the superior offensive player this year. I think he's a little bit higher in offensive RPM than Simmons is. You consider the spacing that Mitchell provides, taking it off the ball, 7.6 three-point attempts per 36 minutes, where obviously Simmons, when he doesn't have the ball, I think he's a liability offensively. You know, he does a good job of moving. They have some sets to take advantage when teams help off of him. He can duck in. You know, I'm not saying that he's, you know, isn't a good offensive player, but I think Mitchell is better offensively, and I don't think that there's quite enough from Simmons to overcome that defensively. I actually think that Mitchell's job is, I think he does it a little bit better defensively, even though Ben Simmons, just because he can switch, might be a more valuable defender. I've made that point before. I hope I articulated that. I think that Mitchell gets into the ball more, executes a little more, has fewer lapses than Simmons does, even though Simmons has really edited so much of that out of his game. He deserves a lot of credit. These guys, just to be, have this type of offensive burden as rookies and still be good defensively, is just incredible for both of these guys. But ultimately, I think I am going with Mitchell. You know, what he has done, I mean, both these guys have done unprecedented stuff for rookies, but just to be the main option on a team that's this good as a rookie, and to do it at nearly 30% usage and league average efficiency, is just incredible. Again, this is an absolutely agonizing decision for me. I'm guessing Simmons will probably end up winning it, but you know. And then I think another thing, let me ask you this: who's your pick as the better prospect right now going forward?
I mean, I would say, I mean, because with Simmons, really, the weak point for him is like, I mean, how much of a jumper does he need to just be a completely bonkers? Like, if he has a jump shot like what Giannis has now, I think that's probably enough for him to be just this guy that's kind of uncontainable because of his passing ability and everything else. So I would say Mitchell has a higher expected value to me just because the jump shot is already there and his defensive effort is so good, and Simmons has a higher ceiling. Like, I think I can see a path where Simmons wins MVP, but I'm not quite sure I can see that with Mitchell. It would have to be just so far beyond, and I care more about ceiling than expected value in this specific case. So I still think, and also Simmons is younger, I believe. So
barely,
I would say
they're both 21 ish.
They're close. Yeah. And I mean, because Simmons missed a year and Donovan spent an extra year in college, I believe. And it's closer. I mean, when we do the prospect rankings, both of those guys will be eligible. That will be a very interesting question partway through next year. Oh, and another thing that I found really interesting with the way that you and I did this, and I think this ties in with your question, is you've been more open about the idea of who is the better player being a part of Rookie of the Year. So that would lead me to believe that your thoughts on this might be worth mentioning right now.
I'm too tired to understand what you're trying to lead me into.
Basically, you have said in prior years that Rookie of the Year, kind of the tiebreaker, is who will be the better player.
Oh, better player. The better prospect is.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's where I was kind of going with this. And, you know, I guess like the highest, like 99th percentile outcome for Simmons is better, but I just think the chances of him getting even an adequate jump shot are so low at this point. Like, it looks like the free throws, the fact that he's made almost no progress, his finishing around the rim has gotten a lot better, but just, I mean, he was more comfortable shooting from the 3-point line when we saw him like 3-4 years ago at the Hoop Summit, even. You know, he was taking them in those practices. I don't know if he was making that many, but he at least was comfortable taking them, which you haven't even seen now. So Mitchell, to me, doesn't have that clear of a weakness that I think is just never going to be improved. You know, I think, and I feel pretty strongly that Simmons' jump shot is going to be an issue for him throughout his entire career. And so, yeah, on the very small chance that he improves that jump shot, I would say Simmons is a higher ceiling based on his passing and his size. But I would say that I think Mitchell, for a lot of outcomes, has the higher ceiling. And so I would put Mitchell just slightly above Simmons as a prospect right now. You know, maybe you could say that Simmons could have a longer career because he's taller. But if you asked me who I think is more likely to have a higher peak right now, I would probably go with Donovan Mitchell than Simmons.
I see your argument. And again, expected value in certain ways is more about likely peak than
yeah.
peak is, because 99th percentile outcome is very different from 75th or something like that. Third place Rookie of the Year, Jason Tatum. No real arguments there, right?
None. And then four,
and
we had to go.
Fabulous year, would have won Rookie of the Year last year, you know, going through all that. Well, I was thinking, instead of going through like fourth and fifth place, we just jump into, did you do your all rookie teams? Because I did.
Oh, no, I didn't know we had to do that.
Oh.
Yeah, I guess
yeah,
we were kind of saving
I didn't, we didn't
it, right? Okay.
Do you want me to just do mine?
Yeah,
now,
go ahead.
I'll
let me see if I can catch up to it in a second while you're.
Or you can hear mine and just say what you disagree with. That's
yeah. I mean, I haven't done the research. We'll see whether I can get up to speed enough here while you're
okay.
talking.
Well, we can. So my first team: Simmons, Mitchell, Tatum, automatically. And this does not have to be by positions. It's just
right.
five and five. Fourth, and after this, the order doesn't get as much. It was just, to me, there was Lauri Markkanen and Lonzo Ball were my next two. Markkanen has had a nice offensive season. Defensively, some intriguing signs. I like what he's done overall, and been put in a, you know, in a challenging spot to a degree with the Bulls, playing 30 minutes a game and has played most of this year. I think he'll end up somewhere around 70 games played. And then my last one might actually be most interesting, and Lakers fans might disagree with it, even though it's a Laker, and that's Lonzo Ball. I think Ball has been a better player this year than Kyle Kuzma, even though Kuzma's offensive numbers are better because he's a better scorer, because he can actually shoot. But Lonzo defense has been important. His playmaking has been really, really significant for the Lakers. And I think as an overall impact as a rookie, which is, I don't have a really firm rubric for it, but I think that's closer to what I'm actually looking for. So this is way more for me about more outstanding than, you know, it's not like, oh, well, who played more games or anything like that, because that leads to mistakes for me. So that's my first team. And there are a lot of great guys. I actually had some trouble with the second team just because there were more guys that I liked than there were spaces for. But what I ended up with then I'm not going to spend as much time on this. Bogdan Bogdanovic, really nice year with the Kings. Definitely needs to be at least on the second team. John Collins, strong year with the Hawks. Kyle Kuzma, no real argument there. And if he had played the end of the year the way he started it, then he would have been first team without a question. Jordan Bell and Jared Allen. Allen got the last spot over Bam. Real close call between those two guys, but I just have liked what Allen's done. And he's he's had more responsibilities, especially late in the year. Bam has, you know, when Whiteside has been out, has gotten it, but Allen, I think, has earned the spot. And it's a close call between those two guys, so I kind of made that the difference. But a lot of their guys are having good years too.
No, that's true. And this, it becomes difficult here. How do you treat someone like Dennis Smith, who, you know, in the on-off numbers has been pretty bad, although he's come on later in the season to the point where he actually had to get shut down to help Dallas's tank by shutting him down instead of helping the tank by leaving him out there. But, you know, and Smith has been inefficient. He has been poor defensively, but still as a prospect, I think the point of the all rookie teams in a way is to kind of just look forward to what these guys are going to be. So I would probably have Smith on there. I would probably have De'Aaron Fox on there in the same rationale. I had Kuzma fourth in my rookie of the year, so he would have been on my all rookie team. Ball would clearly first team. Markkanen would probably round that out. Ball, Smith, Fox would all be on that second team. I would probably throw Collins in there as well. And then, I would go with Jared Allen as the last guy, you know, a guy who started a lot of games at center for the Nets this year. And I think he's come on. He was awesome tonight against the Bucks, by the way. Trying to think if there's anyone else I'm missing here. Oh, I didn't say Bogdanovic. He should be on there. He would be on there over, I would say. So that'd probably be it for me. But again, this isn't just, oh, who provided the most value to their team as rookies. I think at some point you have to give more of a feeling of who these prospects are, like kind of more players to watch going forward, that type of a feeling. And so when you, it would be unprecedented for guys like Fox and Smith, who started all year, to not be on the all rookie team.
It's kind of a shame that Tay Dosich can't make it, but he's missed so much time, right? That it's
also like 30.
Okay, so they're hey, you're a rookie, man. It would be hilarious to do like an older rookie of the year.
Yeah.
So like only guys who are 25 and older or something like that. I would enjoy that, but I understand why they will never give it. So there are kind of two other player awards that are the traditional ones. Neither of them has too much drama in terms of the number one overall. Let's do sixth man of the year, just kind of, I think we can do this a little more quickly. Lou Williams is number one. There is no question there. I mean, he's had a spectacular season, more valuable as a sixth man than anybody. And there's a very good argument to be made that he probably shouldn't have won this award because he just should have started, but he didn't.
Yeah.
So he is a new one.
As of this talking, 19 starts out of 77 games. Actually, no, it'd be 78 games now after, because we compiled these during the day today. And last I checked it a couple of weeks ago, he was on pace for, I think, either the highest or second highest scoring average of any player who was ever eligible for sixth man of the year. So that's pretty good. Number two, I had Will Barton. Has played the most minutes of any eligible sixth man candidate this year, though. Again, he's started a fair number of games. It almost seems like now, like, you have to be good enough to start and start a lot when guys are out of the lineup for your team to really make it at this point for sixth man. You know, unless you're like an Andre Iguodala and just an absolutely loaded team like last year. But Barton was number two for me. He's had a good year. Interesting note in Chris Haynes' piece today that he turned down the Josh Richardson 4-for-42 extension from the Nuggets before the season. I think he will rue that. That was supposedly on the advice of his agent, Aaron Goodwin. I don't think that was a great decision, but he's gone out and had about as good a year as he can. And I still don't think he's going to get close to $42 million guaranteed unless the Nuggets just like blink and give it to him. I don't see another team giving him that.
And they have a lot of reasons not to blink unless Kroenke's willing to go into the tax. I had Barton second as well. Again, a big role in their offensive success. And that's often times a key part for sixth man of the year. And then I had a real challenge with the last spot just because it's guys that are two different archetypes.
Right.
And one of them is Montrezl Harrell. Harrell has just been brutally efficient, which I do really like, though it should be mentioned that PER in particular really does value those center types because rebounding and efficient scoring and all that. But who I ended up going with was Fred VanVleet. VanVleet as semi as a proxy for Toronto's bench, but also had a wonderful year in his own right. And the other part that I've liked so much about VanVleet, and kind of one of the tiebreakers of sorts, is that he has done the other thing that I love for six men to do, which is be so good that they often close game. And Toronto has plenty of personnel at his position, you know, but they've oftentimes gone small to success. And I mean, he gets into guys so much that to me, that was the tiebreaker, as it were.
You didn't mention the name PJ Tucker. Was he in consideration for you?
Yeah, he was in consideration as well. Tucker, it's always hard for me with players who it's a different role with him. In another year, I think, you know, his case is kind of similar to Iguodala, except not as much playmaking. And I don't know, part of it for me was also that I think Mbamute has played so well for parts of this year that maybe I took that against PJ Tucker, which I shouldn't have. But yeah, he was absolutely in my consideration as well. Lots of guys had strong years for this as well. But for me, I'm happy with Williams, Barton, and Van Vliet.
Yeah, I think I went with Tucker, but I think Van Vliet is obviously a great choice as well for number three. I mean, to me, Tucker, and this is another one of those ones where a lot of the work that he's done has been as a starter, but he's only started 30 games, so he is eligible here. Because as long as you don't start half the games, you're eligible under this category. I can't remember whether it's half the games or less than half the games, but he's not close either way. So, and I think he just deserves a lot of credit for this defensive improvement, this defensive culture improvement in Houston. Another really key part of their switching schemes. He's hit enough three-pointers to keep the defense honest, and some clutch offensive rebounds late in games as well. I think Van Vliet is more of a traditional kind of candidate, but he's been great, but I think if you had to ask me who would I rather have on my team, PJ Tucker or Fred VanVleet, I'd probably rather have PJ Tucker.
I'll rattle off a couple other guys that I think have had good years that I just want to mention. Terry Rozier, who sure. Also is benefiting like so many of these guys as from time as a starter. Olynyk has had a nice year.
Yep.
Former teammate of Terry Rozier. And then honorable mention for everybody on the Raptors bench. I mean, Pirtle's had everybody. I don't even need to single out another guy other than VanVleet, who I'd put third. All of them.
If you're asking about Tyreke Evans, he is no longer eligible. He started too many games.
Correct.
Julius Randle was eligible for a time, but then became ineligible. Nikola Mirotic is eligible, but he's just dropped off too much with the Pelicans, hasn't played enough games. Eric Gordon is now eligible. He certainly deserves discussion. And Kyle Kuzma is someone that might have been mentioned, but to me, he is one of the worst net ratings on the team, so I'm not really ready to put him up in this conversation either. All right, so that's all of the like fill out the ballot award categories, right?
No, one more. Most improved player.
Most improved player. Yeah, and you know what? I don't think I even had that written down, because just so obviously Victor Oladipo.
Yeah, Victor Oladipo's number one. I mean, just the improvement that he had in the scale. I mean, we talked about the jump to like MVP caliber is important. Well, what Oladipo did is he jumped like four levels. You know, it wasn't a one level jump. It's he made himself from being a decent starter to a bona fide all-star and somebody we both pick for all NBA in 1 year. And that is awe-inspiring.
Yeah, it's been just one of the greatest improvements. I mean, probably the last one that I could go back to that came this out of nowhere was Jimmy Butler, the first year that he really, 14-15, when he just like came back and all of a sudden had all this like ISO jab step game and a jumper and like was all of a sudden the Bulls' best offensive player when they had all this other firepower. They're supposed to be this juggernaut. Not that year. So and maybe like CJ McCollum would come in that category too, although he had done it in the playoffs the year before, so you kind of thought that maybe it was coming, and he hadn't really he'd been injured, he hadn't really gotten as much of a chance. I mean, the Oladipo certainly gotten plenty of a chance. So yeah, that'd be it. Anyone else that you think deserves mention or you had something else to say there?
Yeah, so I actually did fill out a three-person ballot for it, and I didn't really do a ton of digging because it's like when you already have the number one kind of like, yeah. But so what I went with was Spencer Dinwiddie with two. He's really had a nice year and gotten a big opportunity and delivered in that. I mean, if it had just been the early part of the season where, you know, there was this curiosity that the Nets were playing so much better when Dinwiddie was on the floor than when D'Angelo Russell was on the floor, then that would have been something. But he went into the starting role. I thought he did a nice job there. And then my number three is Julius Randle. He has really come on late in the season. And if the really positive sample for Randle was bigger, he could have been higher on this. He wouldn't have passed Oladipo. Nobody was passing Oladipo. But I really wanted to give credit to Randle. I think he's a much better player. And then the biggest thing that has happened is last year, one of the open questions was, well, you can't defend well enough with him at center to really make that work. And I still don't think you can as a starter. I'm still questioning that. But his overall performance on that end has also been positive, even though the offensive end has been big gains as well.
Yeah, well, and he's been so good offensively now that the question is more, well, how are you going to defend him than how is he going to defend you in a lot of matchups?
Right.
Another guy who deserves mention here to me and would have gotten so much more attention had he either A, been traded like he should have been, or B, Memphis just hadn't been such a shit show this year, is Tyreke Evans, Tyreke Evans was basically done last year. I mean, he got a 1 year, $3.3 million $20 million contract. And I think, you know, we thought, all right, maybe that's a good flyer, but Tyreek Evans was a wonderful offensive player this year, and the jump shot really fell for him. So, you know, I would probably put him above Randall on my ballot, and Dinwiddie would be in there too. And Van Vliet is another guy who was totally fringy.
Sure.
So we can transition. Our biggest surprise player, it's got to be Oladipo again, I would say. And pretty similar list of candidates, except the other two I would add, Donovan Mitchell to do what he did this year as the number 13 pick. And then Kyle Kuzma, same thing as the number 27 pick, just completely coming out of nowhere. Other than with the genius Mike Schmitz, who predicted Donovan Mitchell for Rookie of the Year. I don't think anyone else did that.
Well, Locke kind of did, Kim, when he said he would score 15 a game. And I said if he won, played 15 a game, then he would have a good shot at Rookie of the Year. And that ended up, you know, Locke kind of had it right there.
Yeah, a good biggest shot surprise with everyone except for you, apparently.
Yeah. Biggest surprise team. I kind of went in two realms with this because I think they both deserve it for different reasons. So relative to preseason expectations, it's the Indiana Pacers, because we talked about this in the over-unders. I mean, we were both thought it was a close call with over-under 31.5, and they're going to get close to 50 wins. And it's not like they had this big buying spree at the trade deadline or anything like that. No, it was just the players they had were way better than we thought they were. And then the other one surprise team is kind of along those lines. It just happened in season, was Boston losing Gordon Hayward 2 minutes into the season. We both thought they were like a low 40s win team after that. And second best team in the Eastern Conference, probably the fourth best team in the league overall this year.
And then you consider that Kyrie's going to play, what, 60 games or something too, to get to this level has been remarkable. They would be number one for me for that reason, but that might even be unfair to the Pacers. And, you know, I was thinking about it. Oh yeah, the Jazz would be it, but the Jazz are only going to be 9 wins more than they're over under, probably 8 wins more than they're over under, and the Pacers are going to be 19 more. So that would be it probably. I mean, I agree with you. The Celtics, obviously, those over-unders didn't realize that Hayward and Kyrie would have, they'd have all these issues. And the Raptors would be another one too. Blazers would be another one as well, just to be the 3 seed, even though that's probably overrating how surprising they were, just due to the fact that some of these other teams are disappointed, and they've, you know, they've maybe been 5 wins over their expectation, 6 wins over their expectation. I mean, a big, with the coach of the year candidate so strong, I mean, you have to throw the Spurs in there too, if you want to, just because of, although I, you know, this wasn't like that far off from what I would have thought the Spurs would have done without Kawhi. So just because
I would have thought mid 40s, because they still out execute all these bad teams. They would have picked up those games, but they got a couple extras. So yeah, they improved, but not anything like what the Pacers did.
So biggest disappointing team, the Cavs have improved so much, especially under Larry Drew. They've won 9 out of their last 10 now. They've looked fine on the year, especially without Isaiah Thomas. They've looked fine, but nonetheless, they've been so reliant on clutch play. They certainly have the most disappointing net rating in the league, to be basically even, and just to be 29th in defense. I mean, that's just, I mean, think of what other teams are out there that have just have not been trying for months and months.
Like, yeah. this isn't a historic opponent 3-point shooting season or just some sort of thing. No, they've just sucked. They have sucked on defense this year. And even as they've been winning these games, it hasn't got, I mean, it got better for like 5 minutes in their win on Thursday over the Wizards, that crazy, crazy game. But they're still bad defensively, and it's still a real concern. And the other thing for me is I do not consider teams that were disappointing almost solely because of injury in the same category. So yeah, like Memphis fell far below their expected win total, but they basically didn't have Mike Conley this year. So that's an entirely different kind of disappointing, and I don't think it fits the spirit of the award.
Yeah, same thing with the Spurs, obviously. So the Bucks would be my second. Even though they're going to be right about where their over-under was, we didn't know that Bledsoe trade was going to happen. And also, we didn't know that Giannis was going to play as well as he's played this season. And to see how well he's played and to still just, you know, be not that much better this year is a disappointment to me. But I would still go with the Cavs, even though I have them as the favorites to come out of the Eastern Conference. What about player? Anyone come to mind for you there?
Well, yes, somebody did. Andrew Christian Wiggins.
Oh, that's his middle name, huh?
I looked it up.
I feel like you only should do that when you're saying something positive about someone. And
I just had to say, I have used his name so often in disappointing contexts, I thought I had to bring some variance into it.
Yeah, that's probably got to be it for me, too.
I mean, career low in PER, career low in true shooting, despite having Jimmy Butler and Karl Anthony Towns on this team. So you thought, oh, he could go into a smaller role. And defensively, he's been better, but he hasn't been as good as I had hoped. And a lot of guys didn't really disappoint this year. So I felt pretty positive about this year, so there weren't as many good candidates.
Though. Okay. Carmelo Anthony.
Yeah, I guess offensively, because we knew he sucked.
Yeah, but we didn't. We still didn't even know that he sucked this badly defensively. Like, he's been exposed so much, and, you know, I don't think the teams did this when he was on the Knicks for whatever reason, but now, you know, he's with all these other good defenders that you don't want to go at, and so now he's being exposed in that way, too. So, I mean, I think he's been even worse defensively than I thought he would be. I mean, I'd never really seen him that much try to, like, defend guys on switches or defend in the pick and roll. It was more kind of like, okay, you know, we're hiding him off the ball. He's not very good as a help defender or rim protector. But the way he's been exposed on the perimeter, I didn't know he was this bad on the perimeter. And then, and I think he's also taken a step back even on the perimeter as well. And then just to not even be able to hit a shot. I mean, the fact that he's been a negative offensive player this year, and that's really pretty remarkable as well. So I thought he would actually help OKC. That obviously has not been the case. We criticized the Knicks for that trade. That was wrong. They just even getting off of his salary was a coup. And to get McDermott, who they ended up getting a second rounder for, they ended up getting that Bulls second rounder. Cantor, you know, he's at least has some value, even though he's bad salary. You reduce, you know, the bad salary that they owe next year by about $10 million or so. With that early termination option that I think Carmelo Anthony may happen to next year. So, yeah, I would go Carmelo because it's just, I think Wiggins, this kind of a performance for me, like, does it really surprise you that much? Like, being honest about Wiggins.
It doesn't surprise me, but that's because I didn't have faith in him in the first place.
I mean, what's
place.
He shooting on threes? 32%? Right, I know. But so if you didn't have faith in the first place, how is it that you're disappointed, right? Like,
because it was a best case scenario. I thought that, you know, if it was going to work for him, it was going to work this year. All the stars aligned for him, and I was open to the idea that he showed some signs late last year that this is what he needed to really activate. And also, I would say that his willingness to shoot the ball as much as he has, yes, Minnesota has had a wonderful offense overall this year, that to a point, I think that it has been detrimental to what they've done, though they've succeeded to a point in spite of it.
I mean, their offense is still really good, right? I mean, we bitch about their offense right. So much. But yeah, I mean, I guess it could be even better with better structure and more chances for the guys who deserve them. But nonetheless, yeah, I think I wanted to agree with you. And then I was kind of like, you know what? If I had to pick the most disappointing player to everyone else, maybe it would be Wiggins. But for me, this was kind of, you know, this is a mild disappointment because I just wasn't as high. I mean, I wasn't expecting him to shoot in the high 30s on threes this year. You know, I didn't expect him to like get religion on not taking long twos anymore when he had the ball. Like, he had 29% usage last year. You're just gonna stop shooting? Like, that seemed pretty unlikely. So he's also done a little bit better defensively this year. I think he's improved more defensively than I thought he might, so that's part of this too. He's improved more at his effort level. So yeah, I to me it's Melo. I mean, we don't need to argue about this too hard, but I Melo is the obvious one because he just, like, nobody in there on earth thought that he would just, like, not even be able to make a jump shot.
I don't know if you did executive of the year. I did. I can just say what.
Yeah, who was it?
I think the two top candidates were Morey and Ainge. Both overhauled their teams in the offseason. Ainge, to a large extent, to bring in Gordon Hayward without having to sacrifice that much, though they did trade Avery Bradley for Marcus Morris, which actually, with given the injuries that Avery Bradley ended up having to go through, though I do not believe those existed at the time, so I don't think you gave Ainge much credit for that. And, I mean, Isaiah Thomas was a damaged asset. I mean, that was a part of what ended up having to go on with the trade. The sides knew it. That's why they had to adjust the compensation. But the reason I went with Morey is that Ainge had way more assets, or the term that I've been using more recently is team building tools to work with. He started with the number one pick. He started with awfully close to max cap space and other draft assets. And Ainge did very well with those. He did better than I anticipated. And I was very critical of the offseason they had. And that turned out to be largely wrong. But Morey got Chris Paul. You could even make an argument that they gave up a little bit too much in that trade relative to the leverage that the Clippers had. But they replaced some of that talent with just superbly fitting players, getting PJ Tucker, maybe the last couple of years that'll be a little bit shaky. And Mbamute for the minimum is an absolute heist. And not only did Morey build a great regular season team, but he built a much more dynamic and dangerous playoff team specifically for the one team that mattered most against them, the Golden State Warriors.
Yeah, I would have Morey number one as well. I mean, he was able to bring back Nene, Luke and Mbamute for the minimum was awesome. They kind of struck out a little bit on Tarik Black, but they needed him as center depth. They got, hopefully, hopefully some useful assets on the buyout market. We'll see whether Joe Johnson actually ends up killing them in the playoffs or not. The Chris Paul trade was great. PJ Tucker, fantastic. So all that was good. I mean, to take a team that didn't look like they had much flexibility and get it to, you know, a 65-67 win season, number one seed in the West, it is incredibly impressive. Ainge would be up there for me, although I'm a little uncomfortable, and we should have talked about this yesterday, or on Thursday rather, about the Kyrie thing. You know, we didn't like that trade as much. Then it turned out that it was looking really good for Boston. Now it's maybe not looking as good. We'll see what happens in the lottery. We'll see if Kyrie can come back. You know, I mean, that's going to be a big part of this as well. So it might be a little early to judge that trade, and you know, I mean, they're probably more likely than not to lose in the first round. We'll see what their matchup is. So even after all that, the team made it to the East Finals last year, and if they lose in the first round this year, you know, it's a little harder. I know it's a regular season award, but and then the Fultz Tatum thing too, he looks like a genius for that now. Getting that Kings pick is looking pretty juicy right now. We'll see where that ends up. A lot of it is just we don't quite know how those have turned out yet. Whereas for Morey, I mean, you know, we know that they've been really good. I think Utah, you know, getting Donovan Mitchell with that trade was fucking unbelievable. Getting Ricky Rubio was really good also. Recovering, losing Hayward by, you know, they re-signed Joe Ingles to what seemed like an overpay. He's well-earned that contract this year. They brought in some good depth pieces. Jarebko has really helped them then. To make the trade for Hood, they've really taken off after they got Crowder as well to move on from Hood. He's not shooting it well, but still has helped there. So for him, and they're going to win almost as many games as last year after losing Hayward. I mean, that's just absolutely unbelievable.
Well, and they didn't mortgage the future to do right. It. A lot of flexibility. You know, Thabo got hurt, and if they had given him a multi-year contract, that would have been a much bigger deal. Udo, I think that's going to end up looking pretty good for them. So yeah, I mean, Utah has more flexibility than you would have expected from a team that had to pivot so quickly. And yeah, fabulous job. And I mean, the trade for Donovan Mitchell, holy crap. I mean, that's a franchise changer.
You know, Sam Presti, we thought that he would be in this conversation. That was not the case. Maybe that means we need to give Kevin Pritchard a little love here.
Sure. I mean,
yeah,
they traded Paul George and got better. I don't think that's at the kind of same level as some of the other ones, but definitely better than, like, if we go through our offseason grades again, that was probably the one that will change the most off the top of my head.
They traded Paul George and got better and got a better player than him. I mean, if you I could offer you Paul George on his next contract or Victor Oladipo going forward, it's clearly Oladipo at this point, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's not even close, because now you're gonna have to pay Paul George $33 million a year. He's gonna get the Blake Griffin contract.
Yeah, also Sam Presti's extension on Victor Oladipo looks a whole lot better now than it did after last year.
Yeah, well, you know, if he'd stayed in OKC, who knows what he would have become, although he did get into much better shape even before the trade. But and then this is one that I think might be controversial for you, but I don't know how Tom Thibodeau can't be in this discussion. I mean, he has to be.
Well, the Jimmy Butler trade, yeah, is massive. What they gave up, I mean, yeah, Chris Dunn has had a better year than you and I both anticipated, but, and remember, they also got back a pick in that trade. They ended up using that pick on Justin Patton.
Yeah,
but they, yeah, I mean, Thibodeau, if basically all he had done was the Jimmy Butler trade and then just done absolutely nothing.
Well, you know, and we can quibble with, I mean, the Taj Gibson signing, I think that was actually a good one. Only 2 years, like, he's earned his salary this year.
I would say so.
Their starting unit has been pretty good,
and they needed a point guard, and Drew Holiday was more money than they could have gotten.
Yeah,
so
Jeff Teague, I think that's looking like a fine signing so far. He does have, that might dry up a little bit, but I mean, they're massively improved, and while if Butler stayed healthy, they'd probably win 50 games this year. They're 8-9 without him.
Well, are we blaming Tibbs for, how do we count in the Wiggins extension?
Yeah. Oh God. Oh yeah. That's no good.
The highs and lows. I mean, granted, yeah. And
also executive Tom Thibodeau allowing him to play Jimmy Butler 70 minutes and then he gets injured. Again, we caution. We don't know for sure that caused it, but you know, maybe not a great idea to push him quite that hard. So yeah, but I think it's got to be Morey clearly, but they're just, it's interesting to talk about some of these other ones. But yeah, the Wiggins extension kills it, though. I'd forgotten about that.
I want to give some credit to Masai Ujiri. I mean, there are two different components of this in terms of player development and drafting, but they, I mean, if one of their organizational goals was to get underneath the luxury tax and not get worse, somehow they were able to do that. I mean, with the overhaul in terms of the offense.
How about just not firing his coach, which many people thought was going to happen.
And OG's had a wonderful year, and Damari Carroll certainly would have helped, but assuming there wasn't really a market for Valanciunas, and Poeltl wouldn't have, I think starting the year with him in that spot would have been very challenging, that it's really worked out well for them. And again, high degree of difficulty, and also not giving Lowry and Ibaka, pay them a lot of money, but over fewer years, I think that trade-off is going to work out very well for the Raptors long-term, to just not have those guys on as long of contract.
Let's do the monthly trend real quickly. We didn't make any... Oh, no, I guess we did do predictions. So our monthly trend...
Oh, God, I didn't look at mine. I'll look at them now.
Yeah, mine was that we'll continue from February, was that the Spurs would continue to play barely better than 500 ball, and that has proved to be correct. They have a 0.3 net rating since March 1st. Or, I'm sorry, no, they had a 0.3 net rating since February 1st, and then since March 1st, they're 9-8 with a plus 2.3 net rating. So pretty close there. They had been really on fire, and then things turned for them in February. And then the February monthly trend that I thought would be an aberration, the Lakers had a 6.4 net rating in February, and I predicted that they would play at 500 or worse the rest of the year. And since that prediction, they are 8-10 with a plus 0.5 net rating. So close to right on both of those.
So my trend that would continue was Memphis having the league's worst offense. It has not quite continued. They're 27th, but part of the reason they're 27th is just because a few teams fell past them. Also, the surprising brilliance of Marshawn Brooks has actually has helped that, despite all of their injuries.
That's amazing.
And Marshawn Brooks, who got Shams called it a guaranteed 2-year deal with Memphis. We'll see what the actual terms of that are. So that could end up working out interestingly for them. That one, I didn't get it exactly right, but I think I got it fairly close. The principal was right. And then the other one, I'm pretty happy that I got this one, at least partially, was that Houston had the second lowest turnover rate. I think that was for the month of February, and that just seemed unrealistic to me. And they're 10th in the span since then, since March 1st, and 10th seems a lot more like it. And yes, they do isolate a lot, but Harden throws some really ambitious passes, and they're still a spectacular offense. They're second in the league in offense during that span, but I just didn't think they were going to be one of the two lowest anymore, and they weren't.
Okay, so we've still got dunk of the year, but first I want to talk about the best dunks from March and April. Probably the number one for me would be LeBron coming down the left lane line and just putting it on Yusuf Nurkic. That was on March 15th, Cleveland at Portland.
I want to make a note about that dunk, because when we're watching the montages, I realized something with LeBron. He is just completely indifferent to whether people are there. Like, there was that dunk he had over basically the entire Nets team. I just don't think he cares. It's because nobody's going to stop him, so he just jumps and does his thing, which should some ways make it less impressive. It doesn't at all, because he's LeBron James.
No, that's a great point. Like, if he's close enough to the rim to dunk it, like, the only way you're going to stop him from dunking it is, like, you get your chest in between him and the rim, so he just cannot physically get close enough. Like, just going up to block it, he just has so much confidence in that left calf and his ability to dunk it so hard off of one foot. Like, and he's not scared. Like, he's going to go up hard unless your chest is, like, right between him and the rim and you're meeting him pretty far away from there. That Zubac dunk last night was pretty awesome, actually.
On Zubac, the Spurs. Also, Paul Millsap getting posterized on back-to-back nights. First one by Joel Embiid, second one by Jakob Poeltl. That was special. That doesn't happen very often.
Probably my number two, though, would be DeMar DeRozan's double pump and one on Tolliver, which I think sent the game into overtime, or it gave them the lead.
You could make an argument between that and the Valanciunas dunk, both Raptors, that it was the kind of the dunk of the year in terms of combination of dunk difficulty and significance because of what it did. But DeRozan's was more difficult in a way because both of them got hit on the dunks. Neither got called for fouls. But yeah, that DeRozan one was pretty awesome. And in the circumstance, I mean, that was a game where they had been a little bit sloppy. The Pistons were still in it, and it got them to overtime. And I believe the Raptors won that game in overtime.
Yeah, they did. That was actually one of my nominations for the game of the month as well. Larry Nance had his monthly obliteration, this time on Mason Plumlee of the Nuggets, coming in from the left baseline. And just Nance, his arms are so long and he just holds it back and he'll just bump into guys and then just keep rising over them. And he like seeks out their chest. It's pretty awesome. Jabari had another nice one on John Collins with the left. And then DeAndre Jordan coming down off the lane. It's rare that he'll be a 1 foot dunker, but he can still get off a 1 foot. He did like the Michael Jordan, like extended out, like one hand double pump, like almost from the free throw line. That was pretty nice. And then of course, Rick Carlisle's favorite dunk of the year, Dennis Smith bouncing it to himself on the fast break. That was pretty sick too.
The dunk contest dunk. Yeah, that was impressive. And it reminded me kind of that Paul George. Was that a 360 that Paul George pulled off in a game when he was younger?
Paul George did. That might be the best in-game like kind of dunk contest style fast break dunk that I've ever seen. The Paul George, like Vince Carter reverse 360. I think it was against the Clippers in 2014.
That sounds right.
Yeah, that was awesome. And I remember I asked, like, this is when I was like really uncomfortable talking to players, like my first year covering games. And so like, I was like, hey, David Wetless, like, have you ever seen anything like that? He's like, oh, it was a pretty good dunk. Like, fuck off. Basically, he didn't say that, but like, so I don't know who you are. But I think our dunk of the year, we're both going to have the same one, aren't we?
Probably.
Giannis, Tim Hardaway Jr.
How the hell does somebody dunk over a human being in an NBA game? Like, yeah. I mean, Vince doing it over Frederick Weiss is a completely different thing, and it will probably never be topped. I mean, I love the Tom Chambers dunk. It's one of my favorites, but Giannis dunking over a 6'6" guy who didn't see it coming is just completely insane.
Yeah, and it was like, no one, you didn't even see what had happened at first, and then they showed the replay, and you're just like, oh, okay. What are some of your other honorable mentions? I think that LeBron on Nurkic would have to be up there for me. The Maxi Kleba on Julius Randle.
I was watching that live, yeah, and went completely too. Insane.
The Dominique style, like two hand, pull it to the side and dunk him with like a minute 30 left in the game. That was awesome.
I heartily enjoyed Joel Embiid on Russell Westbrook, partially because Russell Westbrook flopped and just got dunked all over. Yeah. I enjoyed that from a satisfaction perspective.
Giannis is that alley-oop on Baines in like the second game of the season.
Baines got posted again this month. Who was that by?
Oh god, I mean, it happens all the time.
Carl Anthony Towns. Yeah, that's it was.
Yeah,
and part of it, you know, it is kind of a badge of honor with these guys because Baines contests a lot of shots. So
oh yeah, like Jared Allen is the same way. Like him, he really, like Anthony Tolliver is the same way too. I mean, like, you, if you're gonna play hard, like you need to get dunked on every once in a while. Like that's actually the mark of a good defender a lot of times.
I think it was Julius Randle. So at the Kobe retirement game, the best dunk I saw in person this year at the Kobe retirement game, three different Lakers dunked on Kevin Durant in the first quarter or first half, and I think Randle's was the best of those three off the top of my head, but that was ridiculous.
Okay, best win of the year.
This one was actually pretty clear cut for me in terms of the larger significance, and it was the Toronto Raptors beating the Houston Rockets in Houston in November. I don't remember the exact date. It was the only game Houston lost in November, and it was kind of the sign of, oh yeah, these Raptors are for real, and they're getting the number one seed in the Eastern Conference. It was a nice win, and why I liked that one so much was also they were a very good team playing a very good team who had a good game. This was not dominance over an off night or anything like that. The Raptors took maybe not Houston's best shot, but something pretty close to it in Houston and came away with the win.
Yeah, in that vein, you would say that Houston's win over Golden State would be up there as well. That was a game when the Warriors were at full strength, the Rockets were at full strength. We knew how good the Rockets were at that point. It was the last time they were playing. That was really like the springboard to pass Golden State and get into the number one seed, although with all of Golden State's injuries, they would have gotten there anyway. But I kind of like an underdog story on these, so I'm going to go with the Celtics over the Jazz just about a week ago. No Irving, no Horford. Jazz just absolutely on fire. Celtics don't even have anything to play for, and winning it on with Brad Stevens going to a 2-3 zone, drawing up an awesome play for Semi Ojeleye, who passed it to Jaylen Brown, hitting the game-winning three-pointer, down two, by the way, going into that possession. Terry Rozier was awesome in that game. The defense was awesome in that game. Like, that just one, to me, is right up there. And then maybe the other one would be the Celtics comeback on the Rockets at home. But just I just loved everything about that Celtics win over the Jazz. It just epitomized, like, how they've just never quit, no matter who the personnel were this season. So that was the one that I liked. Obviously, a very nebulous opinion-based opinion-based category here, but that's what would come to mind for me.
The other nebulous opinion-based one is worst loss. I didn't do a ton of digging into this, but the one that I remembered most clearly was that Cleveland loss to the Orlando Magic, where they just completely shit the bed in the second half of that game. I think they scored like 8 points in the fourth quarter, and that was the game for me that made me realize there was really something rotten in the state of Denmark. And that was February 6th, and Orlando was, this wasn't like, oh, when Orlando was 8-4 or whatever it was. They had already gone into their tailspin. They were living in their tailspin, and they beat Cleveland by what ended up being 18 points.
I had that one, and then I believe that you will kick yourself for not thinking of this one. Nuggets at Memphis.
Yeah. It's certainly, well,
because
it's certainly
that one's gonna
pick.
That one's gonna matter. Like, that Cleveland game, ultimately it's not gonna matter. Like, they're gonna get a good seed. They're still good. They made the trades. It's just a blip on the radar screen. Yeah, it sucked at the time. That loss is probably gonna keep Denver out of the playoffs to an intentionally tanking Memphis team that was just
had... Don't tell that to Marshawn Brooks and Kobe Simmons, man.
Yeah, but
they were not intentionally
tanking. Those guys were Brooks wasn't even on the team yet at that point, I don't think.
I thought it was Brooks and Simmons that led that comeback, but I could be wrong.
Oh, yeah. No, I want to say it's for them. But in any event, I mean, like, Memphis had lost, what, 17 straight coming into that game? That was the one where
yeah,
you were
that
like,
was the game. That was where I had already written the 15 and 60. I'd already written no, that would have been their 20th loss in a row. I had already written the Memphis loses 20 games in a row. They have a really good lead now on getting the worst pick, which also they're not going to get probably, which is pretty funny. And I had already written all that because that game, I think, was on Saturday night. And then we recorded the 15 and 60. And I'm like, okay, let's just read it anyway for fun. So yeah, that's certainly a worthy pick as well. I just saw in the scope of the Cavs season that was because I think the Cavs season in certain ways was more significant for me than Nuggets, but that's certainly a worthy pick.
Because we are nothing if not pedants. So how do you say that? If you're being pedantic, are you a pedant?
I don't know.
That game was March 17th, 101-94 Memphis. Tyreke Evans did at least play.
He did.
And so did Marc Gasol. But no, it was actually a different Dylan Brooks, who led Memphis with 24 points in 39 minutes in that game. Best game of the year.
I didn't spend a ton of time digging through this because it's also hard with our own records, because you go through this is one that I've always regretted never keeping good notes on. So the game that I remembered the most and enjoying it just profusely, I just absolutely loved this game, was that OKC Denver one when Gary Harris hit the game winner.
I remember that February 1st, that game.
Mm-hmm.
Mine was also in February. Cleveland Cavaliers 140, Minnesota Timberwolves 138. That was the last one before the trade deadline. Ignoring Isaiah Thomas. LeBron hitting that completely insane shot after blocking Jimmy Butler. LeBron, they threw it to him at the free throw line at the opposite end after J.R. Smith started dribbling and they couldn't advance the ball.
When Wiggins didn't help.
I mean, there was a lot of people who didn't help, literally and figuratively, on that one. And LeBron hit that awesome fadeaway over Butler. But the teams combined for an NBA record 40 three-pointers in that game. Cleveland was 21 of 41 from three, and Minnesota was 19 of 33 from three in that one. And there were just a ton of lead changes. I think Cleveland was down by like 5 points in the last 2 minutes of both regulation and overtime. LeBron hit massive threes. He just, it was another one of these crazy clutch LeBron games. And a lot of talent on the floor, a lot of good shooting, and maybe not as much defense, but a ton of drama. So that was the one that I went to. Honorable mention to Boston's comeback over Houston from like 26 down or whatever that ended up being.
That's the game that's marred by the Marcus Smart play, right?
Plays, I thought it was.
Plays, yeah, it was two. That's right.
Yeah, where he drew the offensive off-ball offensive fouls against James Harden. Any others? Just
Boston, you know, played a lot of fun games.
Oh,
yeah. Their Boston's two games against the Warriors were both great.
Yep, I agree.
And I think off the top of my head, that Boston Warriors, the game at Oracle, was maybe my favorite game we did for the Twitter NBA show.
One from March, Jazz at Spurs. Donovan Mitchell, incredible, like, last 2 minutes. He hit that game-tying three where he rose up on the right wing from, like, 26 feet over two guys, but they ended up losing in overtime. Aldridge was awesome in that game. So that was one that comes to mind, too. But, yeah, I think I would go with that Wolves-Cavs game. That was awesome. And hopefully you thought that this show was awesome. Thanks so much for listening. And not sure exactly what this week's going to look like. Danny is out of town. Hoping to have Dylan Murphy on, actually, to do one of these gamers in the next couple of days. And then Danny will at least do the last day of the season, and we'll do the playoff preview, obviously. Philly on Thursday.
Oh, can I plug a couple things at Absentia?
I mean, tell us what ride is most awesome at Disneyland.
Well, I can't do that because I haven't ridden them yet.
Are you only going to be at Disneyland? Can you go to Wet n' Wild too?
Oh, I'm going to be at Disney World. There are two water parks associated with it as well. I can't remember the names of them, but there are two. I haven't been there in forever.
But there was, I don't know if this still exists or not. I mean, the last time I was there was 1995. But at Wet n' Wild, which is a water park that's just in Orlando, they had this ride called the Stuka. Actually, Dare Stuka, it's like one of those super steep water slides that's like, you know, where you have to like cross your ankles or you get like a really bad wedgie, or you cross your ankles and just get a really bad wedgie regardless. They just tell you to do that and then just tell you didn't cross your ankles well enough. But nonetheless, it's like one of those, but you step into this chamber that's just got like, you know, a little window that you can see out of. And then like the guy like hits the button, like asks if you're ready over an intercom, hits the button, and the bottom just drops out of the chamber and you go down this like 100-foot tall water slide. It's awesome and completely terrified me as like, you know, a 10-year-old.
I'll have to keep an eye on it. But so I pre-recorded both Real Jam Radio for the past week, so that's with Rob Mahoney. Really fun conversation. We talked about Kyrie, talked about the playoff picture, and then we did a thing on how he makes the Breakaway podcast, which I really enjoy, and the process behind it. And so I had a lot of questions because it's so different from what we do,
yeah,
that I wanted to talk about that. And so we did that on the show. And then I will talk with Sam Vecenie doing the NCAA tournament in draft review and kind of setting the table in many ways for our own research as we start to do that. Who stepped up? What has really changed over the past of it? And so that will be released on Tuesday, so it'll be soon enough.
All right. And we definitely want to get like a full review of like the best rides, like a full dunked on analysis of like how to do Disney World. I think our readers...
Oh, you haven't seen... You haven't seen my preparation yet. Yeah, there's an insanely detailed itinerary created by my sister and me. Yes. That is absolutely insane. I'll send it to you. And but yeah, that might end up being something for Patreon subscribers. So patreon.com/DuncanLaRue.
Yeah, why don't we just start a separate Patreon just for like theme park analytics? But yeah, I mean, I remember I was so into Disney World when I was a kid. I bought like as a 9-year-old, I had like this book, and you know, 2 months before we were about to go, I would just start reading it and like plan out every second of every day, obviously down to like which country pavilion at Epcot we were going to be eating like overpriced fake ethnic food at. Epcot is so sorry compared to like the real rides places. Are you going to go to Epcot at all?
Yeah, but mostly focus on the food stuff because my family, as you know, is very into food.
Yeah, I it's probably like actually good now, I bet, like 20 years
oh it is
I've last been there.
It is pretty awesome. I was at Disney World in 2012, so it hasn't been that long, and they've changed around a lot. The rides there aren't as good, so for ride oriented people it's there. But yeah, I mean, because we're doing one of the crazy dining plans also, so we're just going to go around and try a bunch of stuff. It's going to be fantastic. Yeah, the food part of it I think is going to be interesting for you because you enjoy that as well.
Yeah, and for those of you who were totally bored by this conversation, it was at the end of the podcast. We already gave you all the content. We weren't forcing you to sit through this to get to the actual good content, but now that content is over and we will talk to you all tomorrow. Till then.